Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and this is the 10 Adventures podcast. Each week, we talk to real people about real adventures as they explore this incredible planet we all live on.
Today on the 10 Adventures podcast, I'm joined with Karen talking with Ryan Meskill about a pretty incredible 1,800 kilometer bike ride from Brighton on the UK's southern coast down to Budapest, which he just did this summer. Ryan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm always interested. What inspired you to ride from Brighton to Budapest?
I lived in Budapest for a long while, and I've just got a lot of friends there, and I've been in the UK now, and just stuck in COVID lockdown and started toying with the idea of a touring bike, and then started touring with the idea of a tour. And then one thing led to another, and I bought a custom bike, which took 16 weeks to make. And by the end of it, I had a route and had an idea, and that was about the end of it. But it kind of came together suddenly and weirdly slowly at the same time.
So I'm interested. You said you hadn't done a tour, but you got a custom tour bike. How did that happen?
Yeah, kind of a COVID splurge, I suppose. But I'd been toying with the idea. I do 1 to 5 day tours. I've done the whole Danube. I've done a lot of riding around the UK and a good bit in Central Europe. I shouldn't say the whole Danube. I should say the beginning of the Danube back to Budapest a couple of years ago. But it was always maximum 5 to 7 days of bike packing trip with one of my other bikes. And I'd always just kind of gotten really excited about the idea of a long tour, but just never could bring myself to quite decide on what I wanted or decide on where to go. And then middle of 2020, I think I started to look, and it seemed like there were essentially no bikes left to buy. And then I just kind of got the bug. And when I had my heart set on several ones, and I couldn't get them locally and I couldn't get them imported, and I had to wait for the 2021 model, and that just led me to splurge and get my own custom bike.
Well, that sounds like the way to go, because I guess if you have a bike that fits you perfectly, it's going to make a longer tour quite comfortable.
Day 1 and 2 on the brand new saddle were a little bit rough. By day 23, I was fine, yeah.
How did you decide with this custom bike what you wanted?
Part of it was a lot of Reddit and a lot of Googling and I'm a bit of a gadget guy, so I got a little bit excited by all of the options. And then quickly, as I looked at some of the price tags, revised my estimates down. I found a couple of custom builders in the UK who do some really lovely stuff. And I just started writing them back and forth and asked for recommendations, for lack of a better decision-making process. And they're really lovely people. And the one that I settled on was Simon Stanforth. Down in Brighton, which is why I started my tour from there. And he was spectacular at getting me set up. And I basically handed it over to him and said, here's what I want to do. And he went, here's what your best options are. So admittedly, I wasn't an experienced tourer, but between the internet and some smart people along the way, it really helped.
I'm the exact same way. You know, I'm not a big gear hound. So I often just find somebody who knows a lot, who loves to figure all this stuff out. I say, just tell me what to do. Like, this is what I want to do. And it always works out, because there are people that love that aspect. But, if you aren't willing to spend the time, you can never know it as well as someone, especially the guy who's building bikes. He knows how to do it. So I bet you got a fantastic bike. In terms of your route, how much did you plan of your route? Like, did you know kind of every day? Or is it just, I'm taking off, I'm picking up my bike, and I'm going to, you know, cross the channel, and I'm going in the direction of Budapest? But you know, that's all you had.
I had a rough route planned out in advance. I was going to go through Belgium and then central/northern Germany. I mean, I guess it's central through Cologne and Essen and on through Dresden and Prague and then to Budapest. But COVID scrubbed all those plans pretty much the day before I went. Belgium brought in restrictions from anyone coming from the UK, thanks to the Delta variant. And I started from scratch. I was going to ride from Brighton all the way to Calais and just didn't manage to do that. So I instead crossed at Dieppe, and I got off the ferry and immediately looked on my phone and found the next route. And every day it was one day at a time, basically. And I mostly set it based on where the next campsite was or where the next point of interest was and about my maximum distance for the day. And it was a day by day thing. I had an end date, and I had a plan to meet someone 2/3 of the way to the journey. And beyond that, it was very free form.
each day, would you say, okay, this is the campsite I want to get to? Or would you have a couple destinations or, you know, I might go here, I might go there? How structured was it?
I tried to set two goals for myself. I had a bailout point in case the rain got too bad. And I had an optimistic point. And after the first couple of days, it ended up being a little bit easier because there's a lot more density of campsites. But sometimes I pulled into a campsite after a 75-kilometer day, and it was just gorgeous in a field in front of a French chateau. And they have local champagne that was produced in the next field, and you just couldn't turn around and say no to that.
That sounds wonderful.
So when you were planning your days, were you following an established biking route like a Eurovelo, or were you just making it up day by day? I know I've done both on bike tours, and making it up on your own day by day is always a lot more work.
It's a lot more work for sure. But I mean, I think I had a couple of destinations in mind. So I wanted to see Strasbourg in France, and I needed to make it to Salzburg in Austria. So that at least gave me some pins to work around. Then the initial route, the ferry that I crossed by happenstance into Dieppe, is the main route from the UK to, from the London to Paris route. So much of that is signposted for the first 3 days, basically, or I guess it was 2 days. I followed that. But from there, it essentially went day to day. And sometimes there were people I met in campsites who made recommendations as to which way I should go or another. And sometimes I just kind of looked for the next point of interest or the next campsite I wanted to aim for, or the next town that was appealing. But yeah, it was pretty much every day. I sat down when I set up my tent and I made my next day's worth of plans.
And so how did you plan your routes? Because I know when I've done trips where I've had to plan my routes, I was using an assortment of apps to try and see which would choose the best bike route for me. How about you? Like, did you find one that worked well, or did you use a combination?
Historically, when I do rides, shorter rides, I usually do some combination of Maps.me or Komoot, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but it's a German app.
Yeah.
Which does a pretty good job of giving you surfaces, which is quite important when you're riding more of a road bike on a bike packing tour. But obviously with a slightly more loaded and beefy touring bike, it wasn't nearly as concerning to me. But just before I set off, I saw a recommendation on Reddit for a website called cycle.travel, which is done by a lovely guy out of the UK. It's free as far as I can see. It uses open street maps to find the best secondary and tertiary roads if there aren't bike paths to put you on. And basically from the time that I crossed the border in France until I got to Strasbourg, I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but I told everyone along the way, I think I was passed by about 12 cars. So just little tiny country roads. And I think France has a better network of this than elsewhere, but it was spectacular. So yeah, that was my primary thing. I sometimes try to use Google, but I always found myself on bigger roads and just stayed the course, trusted that even if it was slightly circuitous, it took me on a much better path.
Yeah, that was actually one of my questions, because I think I used to live in the UK and I used to love riding the little small country lanes around London. But invariably, you know, I wouldn't be paying attention and end up on a busy road and think, oh, you know, this isn't fun. So that's incredible that you were able to travel on those small roads. Was it hard to then get those small roads to connect with campgrounds, or were campgrounds pretty abundant for you?
In the first couple of days, it was hard. Day two, I think I was about 45 kilometers in and saw a campsite. And I asked the man, is there a place to stay, or is there any more places after this? And he was very gruff and told me, no, there is another one in 95 kilometers. And I laughed at him and said, sure. I mean, that's what any campsite owner would say. But no, he was exactly right. I found myself in a hotel about 50 kilometers on, and about 45 kilometers after that, I found the next campsite. So probably should trust people you meet along the route a little bit more. But no, beyond that, once I got east of Paris, and I never actually dipped south to Paris, but I was staying in the north and through the regions of Champagne and then on the Marne Canal, there were plenty of campsites. I rarely found myself doing more than 5 kilometers out of my way to find a good campsite.
That's nice. Now, I know that part of Europe can be pretty wet, even in summer. What was the weather like for you?
Unparalleledly rainy. Basically, from the day to the moment that I got off the ferry until the moment that I entered Austria, it rained on me at least once a day. And reliably every night. My tent was not dry until I hit Austria. But fortunately, it was mostly fairly light, or afternoon downpours where I could just stop and have a baguette and do my best to avoid it. But it was at points quite demoralizing and certainly relentless. But yeah, everyone I spoke to along the way in France and in Germany said it was the rainiest summer they've ever remembered. Lucky me to have picked the August, where when I left the UK, it was 27 degrees, or which is 75, 80 degrees Fahrenheit, and sunny. And basically the whole way across France, it was under 20 degrees, that is to say under 70 degrees, and reliably raining on me every day.
And you camped every night. You know, that's impressive, because I hate, you know, I hate having a wet tent. I hate just that, you know, packing up a wet tent, setting up a wet tent. You had the, you know, the will to keep going. At any point, you're like, I'm just going to start staying in hotels. Screw this tent.
I stayed in a couple, but I think the stubbornness of facing down a headwind while carrying a 3 kilo tent in a bag, just going, no, I'm going to use that thing. And admittedly, staying in campsites is always a little more fun. You meet people and you get to share some stories and just connect with fellow cyclists along the way.
So had you packed enough rain gear then?
Oh, heavens no. No, no. I talked to my father about halfway through the trip, and it was, I was in a tent and it was 10 degrees Celsius, 50 Fahrenheit, and pouring overnight. And I was writing my dad and he was like, oh, well, did you pack for that? When I left the UK, it was hot and sunny. No one expected Central Europe to be colder than the UK. So no, I hadn't, but fortunately I don't get cold easy, and I just would wear all of my clothes and zip myself into my sleeping bag and call it a night.
And did all this rain correspond with the floods in Europe? Is that why you were encountered so much rain?
In large part, yes. I think if I'd actually gone through Belgium and through Cologne in Germany, a lot of those regions were, I mean, I may not have directly ridden through them, but a lot of those regions what was underwater, yes. And it was just a generic or widespread wet summer through France and Belgium and Germany.
So when you were going through Austria, you know, were you going through kind of the flatter part of Austria, or were you actually going through the Austrian Alps and having to deal with big, you know, big climbs and descents?
I'm by no means a hill cyclist. Between the UK and Budapest being my main locations, or Hungary being my main locations of cycling historically, not a lot of hills. Though the UK has lovely, lovely rolling hills in parts, I haven't done a lot of them. So I, by all accounts, planned on being a canal / river adjacent cyclist for the most part. I did hit some altitude west of Strasbourg, and then through some of central Germany and in Austria, but by and large, I stuck to the, I went to Salzburg to Linz, and then from Linz just followed the Danube the whole way, which is a lovely ride, but not quite as hilly as it may have been. Though I did have a decision point in Strasbourg where I considered going south and through Switzerland, because you can actually stay through much of Switzerland reasonably along rivers. But when I decided I wanted to go to Luxembourg while I was there, and the altitude was about 1,500 meters in one day, I just thought the better of it and went, oh, I'm a river cyclist.
Is it true that along a lot of these rivers, there's like a dedicated bike path, so you're completely off the roads? I know I've heard people tell me they've done, you know, I think on the Danube and also on the Elbe, where it's essentially car free. Is that what you were on, or were you still on roads around there?
By and large, yes. I've done the Danube in Austria a few times, and it's the Austrians are cycling there is absolutely spectacular. There will frequently be two-lane tiny little roads that wind next to the river, and there isn't room for a cycle path. So they just build a metal one hanging over the river. So you get to literally ride on top of the Danube as you go along. And in France, it's spectacular as well. There were parts of Germany where I found myself on smaller roads. And then obviously as I entered some of the larger towns, but by the rivers, by and large, it was all dedicated cycle track.
Wow, that would make for some pretty lovely cycling for days doing that type of thing. Now, you talked about the adversity of the rain, which sounds like it would have been definitely a challenge. But from what I understand, I understand you had a bit of adversity your first night out of the UK.
Yeah, perhaps there was a reason why I decided to stubbornly stay in tents as often as possible. Because yes, the first night I arrived from the UK, I got bed bugs in the admittedly not the finest quality hotel I had booked for my arrival at about 9:30 in the evening, which of course they don't hit for a couple of days. And when that sunk in and I just went, no. Camp, I can clean my own tent and I don't have to worry about them there. Yeah, it made for a very itchy 3 to 4 days until they cleared up.
Well, I guess that's also made you more committed to tenting, as you mentioned, too, right?
Indeed.
You talked about meeting people when you were tenting, that, you know, in the campsites, it was easier to meet people and get talking to people and get recommendations. That sounds like a great experience. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
There were some hit or miss. In parts of France, it seems that the vast majority of the campsites are people from Belgium and the Netherlands staying for whole summers with their camper vans and essentially no cyclists. And in parts of Austria, it just feels like some of the little campsites I stayed at were essentially all cyclists. And I guess it puts it all in perspective when I thought that I was doing about 85 to 100 kilometers a day and suffered through the rain. And then you pull in at, I'd get in about 5 or 6 o'clock every night and set up my tent. And then someone would arrive at 9 p.m. and say that they'd just done 250 kilometers that day and they had 260 to do the next day. And I was, wow, I mean, well done. So that was not a level that I was ready to hit quite yet. But there were a lot of really lovely people I met along the route. Some people who actually were also coming to Budapest who we ended up meeting up for a drink when they arrived. People going every which way and lots of good stories and campfire moments shared.
In doing such a long journey, are there any parts that, you know, if people are thinking, say, I can't do, you know, an 1800 kilometer journey, but I wouldn't mind going for, you know, a week long, you know, bike trip in that area. Are there any places that really, you know, stand out as, hey, this is really special that people, if they can't do the whole thing, they should consider checking this shorter bit out?
Having done the Danube from the start to through Germany and through Austria, every piece of that is lovely. It's all separate. It's all absolutely gorgeous. Through Germany, you hit some lovely towns from Regensburg to Passau and on to Linz in Austria. And I repeated the route from Linz along, partly to avoid the hills, but also partly because it is a really lovely ride. I'd never cycled in France before, and the canal along the Marne is absolutely lovely. It's an old canal that is kind of partly not in use anymore. The last stretch heading into Strasbourg for the 50 kilometers or so is just absolutely quintessentially small town France. I mean, there's the old lock houses and the old lovely buildings along the way and the canal just trickling through and little towns. And I also can't say enough good things about camping and cycling through France. I mean, every night we'll come through and ask if you'd like a baguette in the morning or a croissant, and you pay in advance and they do just deliver it to you in the morning in a way that you didn't think this still happened in 2021. But it not only does, absolutely part of the culture. I would say you can't go wrong with any part along the Danube, and the section from north of Paris to Strasbourg along the Marne is just a lovely piece of country.
And those are nice as well because they're fairly flat. So I know there's a lot of people, they think, oh, I'd love to do this, but I can't deal with, you know, going up and down a lot. I just kind of want an easy bike ride. Is that what you found, that there, you know, these would be good kind of introductory? If it's your first bike tour, you want to try something, this would be a good place to go?
Absolutely. And I mean, having done trips elsewhere, which admittedly were a little less long, it's rare that you'll go more than 5 or 10 kilometers without going through a town. So there's always an option of a baguette or a croissant, which if you're cycling 100 kilometers, those calories don't count as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, I mean, I think on average, I would do between 80 and 100 kilometers a day. And I rarely had days where I did more than 300 meters or about 1,000 feet in a day of elevation gain. So it's pretty flat, all things considered. There were bigger days, but by and large, it's absolutely a thing that you could plan to do as a beginner.
And that also makes a difference when you're lugging around a lot of gear too. You know, the elevation change.
Absolutely.
Especially wet gear.
Yes, indeed.
I'm interested a little bit about the gear. You know, you kind of started this, you bought a brand new bike. How did it feel? Was it easy to, you know, was all your gear, did you make the right choices, or did you find, you know, oh man, in terms of selecting your panniers and your saddle and your tent, you know, your cooking stove, was there anything there that either really you loved, or on the flip side, oh man, this was a total piece of junk. What was I doing?
I can't say enough lovely things about my bike, but again, I think if you have a custom bike built for you, obviously it should be good. I'm certain that I could have done well with any appropriately sized off-the-shelf bike. But I essentially went into this saying there were two things I cared about. I wanted a dynamo hub so I didn't have to worry about lights and so I could recharge things along the way. And I wanted Ortlieb panniers. And then that is pretty much all I went into this saying. And I, by and large, got out of it what I think I wanted. I've never owned a tent in my life before. So I did a little bit of research, but I just went with Decathlon, which is a very common European brand. They make a pretty good two-person tent. It weighed 2.9 kilos, which is a little over 5 or 6 pounds. It was, by and large, perfectly fine. I wish I'd done a little bit more reading and I could have had a tent which had a detachable rain fly, which is just nice to let it dry off during the day. But again, I've never camped for more than two nights in a row before. So no, my gear was exactly what I needed. I ended up shipping very little home. I think everyone says when you go on a long trip and you haven't done it before, you might find there's a few things you don't need. And for me, it was a drone, because you can't fly a drone in the rain, and I'm not going to lug a kilo of extra weight along if I can't put it up in the air. But no, by and large, I had some really nice stuff that I got, and nothing cost too much. It all made it all the way, and it all did everything I needed to do.
So after doing this, you know, you're kind of your first, you know, properly long bike tour. Is this something where you're like, hey, I love this, I'm going to do more? Or you're like, hey, I'm going back to these 1 week, you know, more manageable trips?
I literally cannot wait to get back on a bike for another month. Everyone I spoke to along the way who wasn't a cyclist thought I was insane. And everyone I spoke to along the way who was a cyclist went, oh, yeah. It's about under 2,000 kilometers. That's not a bad ride. 23 days, that's like a half a summer. Yeah, I can't wait to get back out. I was making a joke about this before I left, that if I couldn't do it, I was going to have to do the Land's End to Jonah Groats ride in the UK of just, well, if I can't leave the UK because of COVID, I'll just ride around. So maybe that's next, or maybe I'll go to Portugal, or yeah, we'll see what next spring holds.
So you don't have a definite plan for what you're going to do next?
I if there's anything 2020 has taught me, it is do not plan too far in advance. It is safe to say that I will be making another one of these trips just about as soon as the weather and border restrictions allow.
I know one thing a lot of people ask is how do you get the time, you know, to take 3 or 4 weeks off, especially people in the US where they may only get 2 or 3 weeks of time off a year, but even in Canada and the UK where you get more vacation. Do you have any suggestions for, you know, how can people fit in a trip like this in their working life as well?
For me, obviously being based in the UK, we're a little bit more flexible. I've got a great company that's very understanding. And I've been at this company for well over a decade now, and I've always taken 2 to 3 week trips, even when I was based in the US. So I've got a big luxury. I think, I mean, obviously the advantage of just fitting things into when natural holidays fall for you, that, you know, whether there's a Labor Day in there or a Memorial Day or whatever, you can work around. The benefit of it, at least in Europe, is being able to know, I knew I had essentially 3 weeks and change to do this, but I was never worried about hopping on a train if I wanted to stop for a little bit more. And if I wanted to go shorter one day, I could always get where I needed to go. And then that's a luxury I know that may not exist in a lot of North America, but it can. I mean, I'm from Washington, D.C., and I've done a lot of rides around there, shorter ones. But I know people who they'll do the same, and they'll just set off, and worst comes to worst, just find your way to an Amtrak station, and you can get back home that way. So just, I think for me, it's being as free-form as possible. Obviously, having some luxury there, but 1,800 kilometers was not the original plan. It was supposed to be a few hundred less, but COVID forced me to change that. And that just meant a few more days in the saddle, but it was well worth it.
Actually, I think that's one of the joys of cycling, though, in Europe, is that things are close together, places are well connected. So just like you said, if you're behind schedule, there's always a way to make up some time.
Absolutely. I lost one day to a washout between Ulm and Munich because I had to be in Salzburg, but it was, I've ridden that route before, so I wasn't particularly worried about seeing every last kilometer along the way. And the most important thing was just to be where I needed to be and to be cycling, not when it was pouring on me.
So when you got into Budapest, were you ready for your trip to be done? Or if you'd had more vacation, could you have just kept on riding? Like, you know, could you have done 6 weeks or 9 weeks or 12 weeks?
Don't tell my girlfriend or my boss, but I would happily have gone the rest of the Danube at that point. I think I always say when you do a long ride, it's never day two that hurts or day 22. It's day three, which is the worst. And then you just get into it. And every morning becomes a repeat of the previous one, but in a lovely new way that you're passing new country and seeing new things. And in my case, literally new countries. You just find it's a lovely routine that is just, you get so zen in. I listened to a ton of books and took a ton of photos and just had a ton of fun. I would have happily gone to the Black Sea or turned back around and come home. But unfortunately for me, I had to start working again. But I might save a little bit more time and see what I can do next year for sure.
Yeah, that's the best part, is just every day kind of becomes the same. And I always feel like you kind of get into this breathing routine. Like I always count my breaths for something. And then it is a bit meditative because, you know, you're just kind of doing the same thing over and over again, that you end up just feeling great. Even though it's tough, you feel great all the time.
It's funny that you said you count breaths, because when I'm cycling, and it's tough. Like if I'm doing a climb, I count pedal strokes, not for any reason. Like there's no purpose in it. It's just like a way to distract my mind. So I'll just, and then I get to 100 and I start again. So it's funny to hear you say you count breaths.
I don't even do it on purpose. All of a sudden, I know something like 97, 98. That's the way my mind goes. Did you have any scary moments? You know, people are always worried about taking, you know, a big trip. You know, is it a scary trip? You know, any challenges you faced?
I think the scariest moment of my trip was that a hedgehog tried to eat some of my food from my tent. No, heavens no. I mean, Europe is by and large incredibly safe, and campsites are incredibly welcoming. And I mean, even some of the more crowded ones where it felt like it was clearly a, you know, teenagers about, or, you know, a bit more transient. I kept all my valuables in my handlebar bag, but I would leave my iPad in my tent half the time, and I never had an issue. Nor was I ever worried about it. Unfortunately, the fact that by and large everything was off major roads, the only thing I'm usually ever worried about cycling are aggressive drivers, and that wasn't even part of it either. So it was an absolutely beautiful breeze. Yeah.
Well, sounds great. And how about injuries? Anything like that to contend with?
I fell off twice, both from an absolute standstill, both because I forgot to clip out from my clips. So,
that's a brutal lesson, isn't it?
I ride with clips every other day, and it never is an issue until it is. And just, I think, not expecting 30 plus kilo, 50 plus pound bike to be quite so unforgiving on the first couple of days. But no injuries proper, just a bit of wounded pride on a bike path as I stood stock still and fell over in front of a half dozen people. No.
Well, that weight does change your balance. I noticed that specifically if you're climbing, when you're fully loaded and you're trying to stand up, you kind of got to change your technique a bit. But you get used to it, I guess.
I had front panniers as well, so I think it took me a little getting used to have the just instability in the front wheel that I'm not used to. That, or I was just a bit brazen, and I probably shouldn't have been a little more cautious on those first couple of days. But no broken bones, no blood, no foul.
Good to hear. Good to hear.
Well, Ryan, this was great hearing about your trip. It just sounds like an epic, you know, beautiful trip. Nothing, you know, not one where you're going to be killing yourself going up and down mountains all day, but you can really just enjoy being on your bike, being on quiet roads, enjoying great food, coffee breaks, and baguette breaks. So thanks for sharing this with us. You've really inspired me. I've never cycled in that part of the world, and now all of a sudden I'm like, I want to go cycling there next summer. So you've done a great job telling your story, and I really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me. It's been great being here, and it was great cycling as well. So,
well, I can't wait to hear where your next trip is next summer, because I'm sure it'll be another great trip for you.
I can't wait myself.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
Yep, thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. If you liked it, why not give us a review? Better yet, subscribe and get inspired again and again. Also, if you want to find your own adventures, why not check out 10adventures.com, where you can use our free resources to plan your own trip or book a tour in over 60 countries and make your own epic memories on your next adventure.